This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. To demonstrate just how committed I am to this podcast, or perhaps better said, how I ought to be committed as a result of this podcast, I'm recording this intro in a toilet. I'm in the WC upstairs on the second floor of the IFC Center while Doc NYC is going on or all around me, and I couldn't find a quiet space other than this toilet in which to record my intro. So I'm going to do a quick intro, and we're going to just go right into the show. Welcome to episode 175 of FilmWax Radio, Doc NYC edition. My first guest up is senior program for Doc NYC, Basil Tsiokas. He's a fixture in the documentary community. And we sit down for a few minutes to talk about what's going on in the festival in its last days here. And then after that, I sat with musical artist Kathleen Hanna, who people know, of course, from Bikini Kill. She was delightful. She's the subject of a new film by Cindy Anderson called The Punk Singer, which is premiering in Doc NYC, but then going to have a theatrical starting November 29th in New York. I believe that Kathleen will be attending screenings over at Nighthawk in Williamsburg for making herself available for Q&As. Let's see. And then afterwards, we conclude episode 175 with a conversation with filmmaker Laura Checkaway, who has a new documentary about a very arresting, unique individual named Lucky Torres, or just Lucky. In fact, that's the name of the film. It's called Lucky. It's a documentary. It's also at Doc NYC, and I'm sure with the executive producing power of Steve James behind this film, it will no doubt make it to a theater relatively close to where you are. So let's get right into this Doc NYC edition of FilmWax Radio. Pleasure of introducing Basil Tsiokas onto FilmWax Radio, Doc NYC edition.
That sounds right.
Yeah, we're here in the right down in the
glamorous Doc NYC green room.
Green room slash what do they call it, like triage center here in, under at the IFC Center for Doc NYC 2013. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah?
Can't complain. A little
tired. You having a good time so far? Yeah,
I am.
Working long hours?
I was here, I was at the IFC Center pretty much the entire day yesterday from about 10:30 a.m. until about 2 a.m. So it was nice. Yeah. Today's been a little less, so.
Yeah. And why were you here so late? Because they have the midnight screenings now?
Yeah, so we had two of our midnight screenings, which we do on the weekends, and we had the filmmakers from Hungary here doing their world premiere. So I decided.
And it was like mid-afternoon probably for them or something.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So we no stunts, no eating anything, but we decided we'd do a brief Q&A afterwards.
How'd it go?
It was good. It was good. People were very happy.
Well, let's just also lay the groundwork for the few that may not know. Doc NYC is an annual. This is the fourth annual festival here. There's 100+ documentaries.
That's right.
And panels.
Yeah, it's the largest one largest one since the inception, fourth edition as you said, and we've now grown to become the largest documentary festival in New York City too, but in the U.S.
Yeah, well that's. Really, yeah, I know. That's impressive after just a mere four seasons. In fact, as we're talking, it's day three, and so far it's been terrific. I'm having a great time. You are the senior programmer.
Yes.
Right? Working for Tom and Rafaela.
Yes.
And where did you... I know it's going to requires a little bit more of a nuanced answer, but where do you find these films? I mean, like, for those who don't know how you how a programmer, especially a documentary film programmer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination. I mean, I go to several film festivals each year. Tom certainly does as well, and through his other programming work at Toronto, he tends to see a lot of newer films because films premiere there. So so he has a kind of advanced look at a lot of films. As do I. I do work with Sundance as well, and so I do have certain favorites that I love that maybe don't necessarily make the cut, or just find out about things that maybe are not ready in time that I kind of keep track of. And so when there comes an opportunity to show them, you know, I remember them, and I sometimes follow up and ask them what they're doing with what the filmmakers are doing with them. And in this case, this year there are quite a few that I have sort of been keeping my eye on for a while.
Oh, nice. Okay. And of course you have to take into account the theatricals, you know, the timing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Of theatricals of other premieres, et cetera.
Exactly. And yeah. You know, and some of them came through the submission process, that we look through hundreds of films to see what we could and couldn't show. So, you know, it's a variety of things. I mean, it's definitely films. There are films here that were winners at South by Southwest. There are films that, have premiered at Sundance. There are films that are completely brand new world premieres. So it's a range.
And you're based here in New York, right?
I'm based here in New York. Yeah.
Okay. This is your hometown. It's nice.
Yes.
You can walk across town.
It's nice.
And
I enjoy it.
Festival.
Yeah. It's good.
For those who might be nearby or contemplating coming to the festival,
yeah.
Haven't maybe bought a ticket yet, what are some of the highlights, let's say? I mean, I don't think anybody would be mistaken to get a ticket to anything, but I'm just curious to know.
I mean, at this point, you know, I program the shorts programs. Mm-hmm. So there's several shorts programs that are coming up through the end of the festival. We've had a couple during the weekend, but the bulk of them are during the week. So there's four really great shorts programs that are worth checking out if you're into shorts. Good diverse group of subjects from kids to obsessive folks to family and nostalgia. So there's a lot going on there. You know, one thing that Tom has sort of made a big effort for the last few years has been to show certain films that have already been on the circuit in some way that we feel and that others agree probably are acclaimed enough that they're going to likely get Oscar consideration or other larger awards consideration. So that's part of our short list. And so those are features that, you know, have already premiered to great acclaim. A lot of them have already been in theaters for the theatrical. But two of them that are coming up before the end of the festival are First Cousin Once Removed by Alan Berliner, which is a really affecting film about Alzheimer's. And then, of course, Roger Ross Williams' God Loves Uganda, which we premiered at Sundance earlier this year, which looks at sort of the influence of Christian of evangelicals in Uganda, which has led to a lot of things like the God Kills the Gays Bill. I forget what exactly it's called, but that's not what it's called, but that's what it's been known as.
So yeah, that's the short list. And I, Alan Berliner was on the podcast actually.
Great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Also, we should mention there's a week of panels or 4 days of panels.
Yes.
Coming up.
Yeah. So the Docathon panels are something that we have found are incredibly, incredibly helpful, especially for any filmmakers that are listening. You know, the thing with the panels, I worked on them last year and, you know, with Tom's guidance. Mm-hmm. And we were really, really adamant that they shouldn't be basic 101 panels you find at every other event. We wanted something that was very practical, that provided real information that can help filmmakers that are actually making films,
right,
make their films better. And so I think that there's a really great range of, I mean, 16 panels, it's a lot. And you're in New York, you're able to draw from a great community here of filmmakers for masterclasses in cinematography and editing, graphics and animation, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, but what I meant by sort of the sort of very general is just, yeah, you know, let's listen to somebody talk about, you know, how to crowdfund. It's not exactly that. You're getting like,
yeah,
you're getting the crowdfunding panel that we have is very much like case studies and giving you a lot of really important information about how to make it work, not just like this is Kickstarter or this
practical,
is Indiegogo. Yeah, it's something
practical takeaways.
Absolutely, yeah, practical, yeah, takeaways.
Right. Tom will not let them get away with less than that.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
Were there other things you wanted
to
mention?
Yeah, you know, there's certainly other, there's, you know, full, the there's still a lot of the festival left at this point. You know, a couple things to look out for. There's a really fascinating film about an outsider artist named Al Carby that is in a film called Magical Universe by New York-based filmmaker named Jeremy Workman. It's a guy that he befriended, like, I believe it's a decade, maybe 12 years ago, who was based in Maine, older gentleman who made dioramas out of Barbie dolls and would photograph them and sort of have them developed to the local, yeah, like CVS or whatever. Really strange stuff, really interesting. And there's, it's about his work and about the relationship between a documentary filmmaker and his subject. And there's a really, you know, for New Yorkers especially, there's, you know, quite fittingly, there's a really beautifully shot film about the reconstruction at Ground Zero called Rebuilding the World Trade Center, which combines still photography and time-lapse and interviews with the construction workers to sort of document mm-hmm. the multi-year process of rebuilding the site. And that's screening with a film by a local filmmaker named Trish Dalton called Bordering on Treason, which looks at the Iraq War through the lens of a photojournalist who was committed to trying to help make the war not happen in the first place. And she was accused of being treasonous for going back and forth to Iran to try to take pictures of local civilians to put a face behind the people.
Mm. What's the film about the guy? I guess he has to move a rock.
That's Levitated Mass. It's Doug Prey, who people will know from Art and Copy and several other films. Yeah, it's quite fascinating. It's really about the role art plays in life. I'm gonna get the number the weight wrong, but it's like 320 tons or something insane. It's moving this rock from a quarry to LACMA, to LA County Museum of Art, mm-hmm. for Michael Heiser's installation, which he put on a couple years back. And it's literally it's all the crazy logistics that are
something
needed.
Something of that, yeah. Yeah. I think when Tom was originally telling me about this particular film a few weeks back, I asked him, was this actually a film made by Werner Herzog? Because
yeah.
It sounds almost like that kind of...
Yeah, it's very
Man
it's very
versus
Herzogian,
nature,
yeah.
Right. You know, epic, you know, right. Very much like pushing up the side of the mountain.
Yeah, but it's fascinating. It's fascinating because the part that's really interesting is when you just see all these local townspeople come by and yeah. see the spectacle of it being moved. And it's, you know,
uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Great perspective on sort of how art works in society.
Was there any other highlights?
Yeah, that's, you know, there's quite a lot. There's, I mean, there's a lot of repeats of films that have like, sold out already. Of films that
in their first run.
Yeah, in their first screening. Screening sold out. So
like
there's
Town Hall.
Yeah, like Town Hall and Webb, Patrolman P, another New York based story, Harlem Street Singer about the Reverend Gary Davis, a great performer and mentor to a lot of the folk musicians of the 1960s and 70s. Yeah, so there's a lot to see, and you know, we try to have a very broad based approach to programming. Yeah. To sort of allow for different audiences to get a lot of different things out of the festival.
So tickets, of course, for all those screenings and the panels that we described, as which are part of Docathon, which is Monday through Thursday throughout the days, can be found and purchased from docnyc.net. But you should come because, and by you, I mean those that are not in the room with us right now.
Yes, exactly.
Because, for goodness sake, there's all the filmmakers are showing up. There's an energy and a vibe that, especially for a lot of New Yorkers who are very plugged in and aware of film festivals that go on, and that we do get a lot of the festival films through New York, of course, but the actual going to a real festival right in the neighborhood is still a very unique.
Absolutely. And you know, you mentioned there's
another one.
Well,
okay, maybe there's another one in the spring, but
yeah,
you know,
it's true. I should say that, you know, you mentioned earlier, I think it's about 130 films that we're showing this year, and I'd say that easily more than 100 filmmakers are in attendance representing their films. So that's pretty amazing.
It is,
you know, to have that opportunity to sort of talk to them about the work they're doing.
What's next for you? When does the Sundance momentum really start gathering for you?
You know, my role, I have some copy to write for selected films at the end of the month, but I won't really have to do much until I get to the festival, and then I'm introducing films and doing Q&As all day long for the entire festival. So,
and you get home at 2:00 and...
Yeah, exactly.
And then the parties begin, of course.
Then the parties begin. All right. Yeah, so that's next for me.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad we finally, I think we were trying to do this.
Yeah, we've been trying it for like, you know, about 10 years now or so. I think that's about right.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
If feel a little self-conscious calling her a rock star, but this is my conversation with rock star Kathleen Hanna.
Hey, everybody. Are you guys ready?
I already knew I was going to be some kind of artist. So I just didn't know what kind.
We were all trying to make feminist work. Like, it was just totally impossible for me to keep it out. I'd read Toby's fanzine, and she was talking about feminism and punk rock in the same sentence.
Toby was like, do you know how to play bass?
No.
Do you want to start a band? Toby was like, I think we should ask this girl Kathleen to be the singer.
It was making music a voice for a lot of people that hadn't been heard before.
Right when Bikini Kill started, right when grunge was like going off the hook, right when Nirvana was exploding. It was a wild scene.
Where are you from?
I'm New York, but I've been...
staycationing?
I've been summering in Queens, which is fun. Not fun. You know, Kathleen Hanna.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on
podcast,
Film Wax Radio. Have you done many podcasts? Have you?
No, I don't even think I've done one podcast.
Fantastic.
So this is my first podcast, I believe.
Congratulations, I think.
May have done one over the phone that I didn't know I was being podcasted. So it was like a secret podcast, and then they did it.
Really?
And they didn't tell me. I don't know.
That's some conniving. But you know what they do? What sometimes happens, you'll do like an NPR or a public radio or whatever radio show, and then they repurpose it as a podcast.
That's what's happened to me. NPR.
Yeah. And then
podcasting.
It's out on the internet. But it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me on your podcast. What's your podcast called?
It's called Film Wax Radio.
Awesome.
Punk Prayer. No, what is
Punk Singer?
Punk Singer. There's another, I'm sorry. Pussy
Punk
Riot.
Prayer is a Pussy Riot.
The Pussy Riot film. Yeah. And it's been on I just had on Maxim, who's one of the two filmmakers again, because of missing Nadia.
Yes.
Tolokonikova.
Nice.
That's
job
the actual
that name, yeah.
I can't pronounce it. Anyway, so I called. We did a little interview, just like getting his reaction to that. But she's a feminist. Do you consider yourself a feminist?
Yeah, absolutely.
I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any level of self-consciousness when you to call yourself that? Because the phrase has been co-op. You know, there's always a response to the term feminist. It goes in and out of fashion. You know,
I don't know when it's ever really been in fashion. I feel like there's always this thing where it's like, oh, it's about, you know, women who hate men or they've been sexually abused. And so they don't like men and they have hairy legs and blah, 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 blah. And like, I'm not a feminist because I love men. And I don't know. I think that it's just there's a lot of stereotypes about feminism that aren't true. Like for me, feminism is about ending the oppression of all people. It's not just about like white women climbing the corporate ladder, which I think is another version of feminism that I'm not interested in. But I also think that there's as many different kinds of feminism as there are women. And the more we argue, the better.
Mm.
It makes feminism
discourse
stronger,
mm-hmm,
when we argue.
Yeah.
Than when we, you know, just like act like there's some, you know, unity that isn't really there.
Right. So did you initially, for those who haven't seen the documentary by Cindy Anderson, did you go into music as a means of expressing your feelings about what it was like to be a young woman and at the time? You know, you were in college, right? You were in college when you started, right?
Yeah.
As a songwriter and as a performer.
Yeah.
And as a designer. Fashion designer, correct?
Or
is
yeah,
that just
I did
sort of
do
a,
fashion. I did do fashion.
It was part of the original show, right?
Yeah.
Like that you were, yeah.
I really came at it from the perspective that I worked at a domestic violence shelter. And
when was this, by the way?
This was in like 89, 90. I guess it was in 89. And I was in a band called Viva Knievel before I was in Bikini Kill.
Uh-huh.
And I specifically wrote about domestic violence and rape because I was working at a shelter and, you know, it was a lot for a 19-year-old to handle.
It's intense.
Yeah, it was very intense, and I needed sort of an outlet for it. And I remember doing it and people saying like, oh, that's just therapy. And I was like, yeah, so what? Like, how is, you know, music made by men not therapy? How is it not them, you know, singing about the things that are important to them or that frustrate them or like getting out their anger or getting out their sadness? Like, why am I any different? And I remember, you know, I went on my first tour and really, you know, there were only there'd be like three women in the audience, and all three of them would come up to me afterwards and tell me horrific stories about how they'd been raped or experienced incest or anything like that, because I actually said on stage, this song's about rape or this song's about domestic violence. And I realized, I was lucky because I had training as a counselor, so I was doing like counseling in alleyways. And I realized,
it was like triage on some level.
It totally was. And it was like, I'm taking what I've learned at the shelter on the road. And part of what my art became was not just making the music, but doing counseling after shows in back alleyways where with women who didn't want to call a rape crisis line or were afraid to go to a domestic violence shelter. And a lot of times trying to point them in the direction of like, well, here's how you can do that, because I can't give you everything in the next half an hour, you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned though a lot of the audience were guys. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was because it was such an aggressive form of music, which would be interpreted before you guys anyway as being very male energy.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason why you are where you are and what you've accomplished is because you changed that perspective, that assumption about the music. It is now can be easily also a woman's music. And so I'm wondering though, early on when you were kind of growing and emerging, and you had so many guys, how they would respond to those very same songs and lyrics, and especially initially, I think.
You know, there was a lot of show us your, or am I allowed to curse?
Yeah, totally.
Show us your tits. There's a lot of that.
Uh-huh.
The most common one was when I would introduce a song, and it was really important to me because we were playing at crappy punk clubs that had crappy PAs, and you couldn't understand the lyrics. I would often hand out lyric sheets specifically to women so that they would understand what I was singing about, because they couldn't hear the lyrics because the PAs were so bad. But also I would talk between songs and say, this is what this is about. And I felt that was really important. Mm-hmm. And that was really the thing that got me the most shit. Men yelling, just shut up and play. Just shut up and play. Over and over and over.
And then finally you started tossing them out.
A couple times I did physically toss people out. You know, our shows didn't usually have security, so I was the security. At one show, actually, it was at a place where you had to do pat-downs before you got in, and they didn't have a female security guard to do pat-downs. And I was like, we're a feminist band, and all these women are coming to see us, and they're going to enter a Bikini Kill show by being pat-down by a man? I don't think so. So I pat-down every woman myself, and it was really funny because no one recognized me, because it was like pre-internet,
really?
And there wasn't a lot of pictures of me available in the universe, so it was really funny then that they all realized that they'd been patted down by the lead singer of the band.
Then the word got out, and then people would come to be pat down by Kathleen Hanna. Because I was wondering, I remember during Punk Singer, the documentary, there were scenes where, because moshing continued, for instance, which was very big in the clubs at that point when Bikini Kill was hitting, you know, their stride, but that guys would take advantage of that and grope and do all sorts of other acts of aggression against the women. And so I remember there was like a zero tolerance about that. I mean,
we did what we could. I mean, a lot of times we would ask women to stand in the front, mainly because of security, partially for us, because a lot of men would get violent towards us. We'd try to get on the stage, would try to grab me. One time our roadie got punched in the face when a guy was trying to punch me. So we had a lot of violence at our shows, and part of the reason we asked women to stand in the front was because...
To avoid that, yeah.
It was like a protective barrier. But also, you know, a big part of our mission was to encourage female participation in underground music. And if women couldn't see us play our instruments, how were they going to get inspired or see like, wow, that's only three chords.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the bass player's only, you know, doing like dong, 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 dong. I could do that. So that was another big reason why we invited the women to front. We were like, if you want to mosh, go ahead. I mean, there were women who wanted to mosh. We were just like, sure. Why don't you do in the back so that we can have women who want to actually see our band.
And that worked out by and large a lot better anyway.
You know, what's funny is, like, after we did a lot of outreach trying to get women to come to our shows, because, like I mentioned before, like, there weren't a lot of women at our shows in the beginning. And so we had postcards that we would send. We would get women's addresses at our – if there's three women there, I had their addresses on a clipboard. And when I went home, I invited them to the next show in the town and said, please bring your female friends. So we did that over and over and over again, and we built a female audience that way. And they just started coming to the front because they already knew.
They figured it out.
Yeah, and what was weird was people it became kind of the famous thing that we did. And there were a lot of times where there was no need to say it because the women had already occupied the front. And people would be like, wait, why didn't you say that thing you're supposed to say? And it would be like, because I'm not a teacher or a policeman. You know what I mean? It's like we did it for a specific reason at a specific time. But there's no reason to keep, like, you know.
Right, you planted the seeds. Now the thing can grow naturally.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
We're on a mission, whether we got attention or not.
Bikini Kill wasn't just the best girl band. They were the best band.
I sat down and said, I can't do this anymore. I realized it was affecting the people that I love. It's overwhelming.
I was really worried.
There's this whole fear someone's going to say, I don't think so. Other people can think whatever they want, but they should have to stay out of my way.
I lied when I said I was done. I knew I wasn't done.
I don't want to leave out the fact that this is a film and that you were involved in the film, and you part of that was a contemporary being interviewed by Sinian. I was wondering, a big part of that was opening up about your health issues. Mm-hmm. And were you at any point a little bit nervous about doing that? And were you, what was that conversation like? In other words, when, you know, it was sort of taking a turn from that typical rock doc bio type of film into something far more personal. And,
yeah.
You know, and just going in a very different direction too.
I mean, part of the thing is, like with any documentary, you don't know what's going to happen during the filming. And what happened during the filming was I got a diagnosis of Lyme disease.
I had it for years and years. Getting misdiagnosed.
Right. I mean, I was told I had Crohn's disease. I was told that it's probably lupus. It's probably MS. And I finally got the proper diagnosis during the film. And I just felt like I have to share this with other people who have similar symptoms, because, you know, I want to spread the word that the Lyme disease test that they give you at the doctor that costs $14 for the insurance company is not reliable, and you need to get a different test, and there's other tests that you can get. And I want people to know that, because I was misdiagnosed for so long because I was given a crappy test twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get the word out. It was important to me. It was, like, you know, really similar to singing about sexual abuse and domestic violence early on. These are things that women and men suffer in silence about. And mm-hmm. Lyme disease is also an invisible illness. It's something that people suffer in silence. And so I really see a correlation between telling the truth about my illness and telling the truth about sexual abuse.
Is there some level, or are you suggesting there's, like, a level of shame around Lyme disease, or?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, because people don't understand it. I mean, with any invisible illness, like with MS and lupus also, a lot of times people can't see it.
Right.
So they don't believe.
There's no obvious manifestation. That
I'm lucky I had an obvious manifestation that was this thing called iritis in my eye. And it meant that I kept getting it. And it meant that I had an autoimmune illness, and there were five of them. And so I went through those five things trying to figure out what it was. And I crossed off Lyme disease off the list because I had had the crappy test.
Okay.
So I actually did have a physical manifestation, but it's not like my friends saw it. You know, these kind of illnesses, they, like, you're well for 2 weeks and then you're sick for 3 weeks, and sure, you're well for 1 week and then you're sick for a month. And so, yeah, it's, I feel like if you're somebody who has felt like you can do anything and then all of a sudden you can't do anything, you know, it's, I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed, and which is really similar to feelings around sexual abuse. And I know it might sound ridiculous, but, you know, you kind of, like, start asking, like, what did I do to deserve this? because it's a really it's a really horrible disease. Perfectly honest, it's really horrible.
And what's your current diagnosis? Status? Yeah,
I am in remission. I've been in remission for 4 months, and I have 3 more kind of difficult treatments left to go, and then I'll be on a maintenance program, and hopefully, it'll be smooth sailing. So,
what is the program? If you can mention it, I don't want to pry too much about it. I don't know what that would be like.
Well, I did 9 months of IV therapy with drugs like Cipro being pumped into my heart, and that was pretty difficult. And then now I'm doing oral antibiotics, and I pulse them off and on. So I have my last kind of 3 pulses that will be difficult, and then my body gets used to it, and then I stay on that same regimen for like a year, and then they start weaning me off. I also take like anti-seizure medications because I have neurological Lyme, and it causes me to have seizures.
Wow. Intense, Kelly.
But I don't have them anymore.
But generally, do you perform much anymore? I mean,
I just got back from tour.
The newer band, the most recent.
Yeah, Julie Ruin.
Julie Ruin.
We went on a 3-week tour, and it was fucking great. It was awesome. I was back on stage. I was like happier than I've been in a really long time.
Yeah.
And I never, ever thought I would be back on stage. And with the film, you know, watching old footage of myself, it was really difficult thinking that was it. That was the best time of my life. And from here on out, it's downwards,
right.
You know, spiral. And but I got a great doctor who gave me a second chance at life. And here I am, you know, doing interviews, doing full press days.
Yeah.
I was on the radio yesterday. I did a TV show. I'm selling a comedy script to Comedy Central.
Really? That's wonderful.
Unstoppable.
She's a machine now. So before we have to wind down, though, the Punk Singer is going to have its premiere, New York theatrical premiere, the 29th of November.
Yeah, it's like Thanksgiving weekend,
very good.
IFC.
All right, so once you're coming off the tryptophan hangover, we highly urge you to go see the Punk Singer. It's a ton of fun. And you learn a lot about Kathleen Hanna, who's a delightful person and an amazing and an iconic performer, God forbid, iconic. And so it's going to be playing, you mentioned Nighthawk in Williamsburg.
Yeah, and I'm doing Q&As at all of them. So
every
single one of them.
Really?
I'm doing one this Saturday.
At Doc NYC, will have been, where is that going to be? At the IFC Center, or is that at the?
The Doc NYC is at SVA.
Okay. Nice. I'm going to have to try to get over there.
Really had to burp this whole time.
Go for it. Right into the mic next time, please. What time is the screening on Saturday? I can at least mention
7:15.
Maybe I'll get over there. I might actually just get over there.
Kathleen Hanna, I'm on Film Wax Reading.
Oh, yeah, sure. Right. Yeah, we can do that.
Oh, switch an ID?
That's great. We could do that after. I never remember. This is why it's great to have help, because I've sat with whenever I have somebody on, I realize I should be better about those promotional things.
So it's
getting
like,
somebody just to say, this is Kathleen Hanna, and
you're
listening to
Film Wax Radio.
I never remember to do it.
No,
I do
it on stage. It's like I'm supposed to say, hey, we have t-shirts and CDs and LPs over at the merch table, and I never say it. And when you do say it, you sell twice as much.
Really?
Yes, I'm a total idiot. Thank God for my keyboard player.
I'm going to come on the road with you then, just so I can make sure to remind you to do that. Thank you so much, and I wish you all the luck, and maybe I'll see you Saturday, but definitely enjoy being the subject of this great documentary. Don't do that. And remember to tell them to buy the merch in the lobby.
I know. I should actually bring merch.
You should. Of course. There's people going to want it. As I mentioned earlier, this is my conversation with Lucky Torres and filmmaker Laura Checkaway.
Tattoos on my face, people would think it's pain, but actually I was trying to find the pain. I was trying to find where the pain is located at, and I couldn't find it.
I don't have parents. I never did. I lived in the system all my life. I've been moving from place to place, shelter to shelter. I gotta survive my own way. I really have nothing to give to my son but my love. Right now, I'm not stable, and I don't want him going through what I'm going through and seeing his mother in pain.
They can't tell me I gotta take all my shit. I don't live on doubts. I'm a go-getter. I'm a go-getter.
I don't believe anybody that tells me that they love me.
So let me introduce you, guy, and let people hear your voices when I introduce you, so that way they know who's talking. I'll say the film is called Lucky. It's a documentary about Lucky. That's Lucky giggling. That's say hi to Lucky. So
hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And Laura Chekwe, is it?
How you pronounce it? Hi.
Nice to meet you too, Laura.
Nice to meet you.
Let's see. How do we start? So, why don't you either or both of you give a little bit of a synopsis or description about the film, and also like how you guys met, maybe.
Lucky and I met in 2007, and the film, we're saying it follows 5 years in the life of Lucky, but I realize that I've actually followed her for 7+ years now, but the first maybe 8 or 9 months was for a magazine piece that I was writing, and then I started filming. So I filmed her for 5 years is around what it is, and the film follows her life. Actually, I'd be really interested to hear what you think the film, what you would say about the
film. There an article about Lucky that somebody wrote and you came across it? Or
no, I wrote an article for the Fader magazine her, and it was a photo essay, and they had never done anything like this before, and it was a 10-page spread that was sort of a fashion, it was a photo essay meets fashion piece, and they were really excited about featuring someone that had just like natural New York City street style. Mm-hmm. So there was a style and fashion element to it, and and I actually already started filming before that piece came out.
Uh-huh.
But we met on the Christopher Street Pier in 2007. Actually, I remember Lucky gave me her number, and she told me, "You're not paying enough attention to me.
Uh-oh.
And you need to call me." And I didn't call her, and I believe, I don't even know if I kept her number or I didn't call her. And another young woman I met that night that was a friend of hers at the time called me. We had exchanged numbers as well and invited me to a party. And remember? And it was like a ball slash party, and Lucky was there, and that time we reconnected, and then she started calling me all the time, and here we are.
But you hadn't made a film before.
I had never made a film before. I had never thought about making
Lucky
a film.
Never thought about it? You were a journalist.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And were you based here in New York?
Yes.
Okay. And Lucky, did you just think, Laura, you saw Laura, met her, and thought, she's going to make the movie about me?
Actually, I wasn't even thinking about a movie.
What were you thinking about?
The thought wasn't even in my head. Like, it wasn't an idea. It wasn't something, you know, that we spoke about, or I ever thought that a movie about, you know, my struggles in my life would be a movie. There's just, like, you know, like, I never knew that she would, like, lay it out, well, you know what? I want to make it just about you, you know? So I don't really know. I just think the film, when I look at it, sometimes it's hard to look at it because it's me, and it's like the mm-hmm. truth is like smacking me in the face.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that, actually. So it's a no holds bar look at you, Lucky, in all moments from, you know, in the waking up in the morning to throughout your day and trying to find work. Your body is, and your flesh is your canvas, can we say?
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot of piercings and you've got a lot of tattoos all over, as we see in the film and as I see in person. So I can definitely confirm. So to try to get a conventional job was not easy. And so that's covered. And then, of course, financially, there are consequences, right?
Yeah.
Which has been difficult, right?
Very so, difficult.
Yeah. So, I mean, how does it feel to, like, for that film, to, like you're on the cusp now, the film is going to get out there. A lot of people are going
to
see this.
Well, a lot of people used to ask me, uh-huh. You know, when the film comes out, how are you going to feel about it? And I used to be like, I'll be nervous as hell, like, for people to actually, you know, people that hung around me for so many years and really never knew the truth. Nobody knew that I lived in a shelter. Because when I walked out the door, I didn't look homeless. I mm-hmm. didn't smell homeless. I didn't act homeless.
Right.
You know, I always looked my best.
Which is great, because in a way you're also, not intentionally necessarily, but you happen to be fighting against certain stereotypes.
Yeah.
About individuals that are in your situation.
Yeah.
You know?
There's
right?
just some people that give up all the way, and there's just those that, you know, even though my heart feel like giving up and I tell my mind I want to give up, but I just can't walk down the street looking the way people look. Like, mm-hmm. I don't understand how you give up like that, you know? Like, I have to look good. I have to smell good.
Oh, I see what you
Whether
mean.
Whether if I'm yeah. happy or not, yeah. you know, but or, you, uh-huh. I don't know, I went through a lot, hold especially a, with the tattoos hold, on my face.
This is slightly off track, but when did you decide to go from making tattoos, like, you know, more or less how most people might have tattoos, where they have the option to cover it up? And then at one certain point, though, you made a decision where you say, now I'm going to go beyond that, and I'm going to make tattoos that I'm not going to cover up, and people are just going to have to deal with this.
My face tattoos.
Did that? So that wasn't first, right?
Like, my face, you didn't start tattoos. With your... Oh, the bitch down my face. I used to be called the bitch all the time, and, you know, I mm-hmm. used to get angry about it, fight people. So I figured that if I get it tatted on my face, it won't bother me anymore yeah. or as much, or I just won't care.
Did it work?
Yeah, it does, because when people call me a bitch, I'd be like, please do tell me something. I already don't know what I am.
Yeah, and who
I
would
have it tatted on me.
Who would call you a bitch if once it is on your face? Like
trust
that's
me,
so original.
I still be called the bitch, but I enjoy it because it's like, thank you for reminding me. I forgot I have it on my face.
Yeah, thank you. I might get that on my face then. Sorry. Laura, so how did you guys get along from the moment go? Did you just hit it off, or was there moments where you were walking on eggshells, and were there difficult spells? It was a period, quite a period of time. You had to have ups and downs.
Yes, I have learned a lot about patience, which I think I already had, but, you know, you have to keep
evolving.
Yes, you have to keep evolving. A lot of times some of the people that were around Lucky would hear the way that, I mean, it's the way that she talks to everybody, but Lucky would call me screaming, and Lucky gets really angry sometimes. And I mean, she was never screaming at me. It was never something that I personalized. And so I guess I would always try to just look through the outer emotion into, like, figuring out what was actually going on with her. And so, yeah. I just want to say that I've learned a lot from it, because I was drawn to Lucky because of her complexity. And so that's not something that bothers me.
Yeah. And in fact, it seems like maybe you were craving for something that she could bring to your life artistically or personally in other ways. I don't know. Uh-huh.
It's funny how you know, just stated that, because when we was in Boston, I had actually said, you know, I think I gave Laura more strength, you know, or more like open to eyes to to things that she've never seen, never felt, or never experienced, you mm-hmm. know, or like, I don't know. I feel like my strength, all my anger and frustration kind of gave her a fight, a will, you know, mm-hmm. her own strength in her own way to keep fighting. Because if this person has never had nothing,
yeah,
fighting for something, you know what I'm saying? And you have it, well, I'm going to fight with you. And then you just keep pushing me because you're the fighter. And now I just want to fight for everything.
So, okay. And what did you learn or what did you get out of your relationship?
Being with Laura?
Yeah.
Relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Laura has been very loyal to me. And I've never been able to trust anybody that's been in my life. You know? So it's like, she showed me that not everybody is bad. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And she's one person that she didn't look at me as a project. She looked at me like I was, like she could be my mother, mm-hmm. you know, a sister, a close friend. You know what I'm saying? So I bonded with her because even when I'm angry, she's still willing to sit there and understand where I'm coming from, you know, and she wouldn't judge me. She'll always have powerful, strong words for me to calm me down and always remind me that I'm a star and I'm special. You know, like,
yeah.
She knows how to calm me down and make me feel good when I'm at my worst.
And she keeps showing up.
Yeah, she keeps showing up. She's never going nowhere. She knows that already.
Oops. There are, by the way, some other strong women in your life that are not just, you know, romantic relationships, but also some older women, right? There's one or two that are in the film.
I would be interested to hear you talk about Olivia and Juju because while making the film, I was so struck by how Lucky mm-hmm. so often feels so alone, and yet she has this beautiful circle of women around her, and in some ways more support and love than some people.
That appear are on the surface more grounded?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
I don't want to play Freud here because it's not my place, nor am I qualified. But you push away people too, right? You're kind of just protecting your heart, and it can make it tough to get close to you.
I think I am the way I am with certain people because I don't see that they're actually being true. So this is the reason why I act certain ways with certain people. You understand?
Oh,
like,
sure.
I'm going to push you away because now you don't show me something different that just made me, you know, think about you in a whole different way. So basically
maybe in a moment of stress, you see it, or maybe you get into an argument and then somebody says something or does something and you see their true colors, that kind of thing?
More like Olivia and Juju, they're both sisters and they're West Indian. And Juju has a daughter that I was with for many years. And how my son, you know, ended up being here is because me and her had planned to have a baby together. Mm-hmm. So basically, she never had kids. So basically, my son is Juju's first grandchild.
I see.
I don't love them the way I love Laura for some reason. Like, the love that I have for them is thank you for keeping this roof over my son's head. Just know that you're not going to take my son from me because mm-hmm. I'm not an unfit parent. I mm-hmm. love my son. Mm-hmm. It's just I don't have stability, no roof over my head for my son, and I'd rather him be stabled than jumping from place to place. To bring this up even more, last month they had brung up about me giving custody to them. And that actually kind of like messed my head up. Like, you know, why would I give custody of my son to you? Talk about, you know, you can come see him at any time. Listen, that's that reverse psychology thing. Because once you give custody to the other person, you lost all rights. So that person could automatically say, you don't exist. I don't want you around here. You could change that child's last name. Like, I experienced this with my daughter that's going to be 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a fool. Mm-hmm. There was a person there that said they was going to help me, and they actually took my daughter from me, you know what I'm saying, and stabbed me in the back. So now I have my son that I did plan, and you think I'm going to allow you to try to take my son from me? He's all I really have. as family. Everyone else that's been in and out of my life, that's exactly what they was, in and out.
I understand. And these things are certainly, they come up in the film. And how do you feel at having seen it? What was your, Laura, did you have like a special screening of the film when you finished it? Or did Lucky see, did she see maybe scenes throughout, or how did you work that out?
Yeah, we were invited to show the film at Hot Docs in Toronto mm-hmm. in the spring, and Lucky had never seen any footage mm-hmm. of the film, and I wanted to have a private showing with her, and she kept refusing and saying she only wanted to see it with the crowd, and I said, I think it's the responsible thing to show you, because I didn't know how she would react.
Yeah. I think the responsible thing was me reacting the same way the crowd reacted. I wanted to see.
So sure. Before going to Toronto, we had a small screening of just about a 20 to 30 minute excerpt at a community center in the Bronx, in Hunts Point.
I'm not sure if we mentioned Lucky lives in the Bronx.
Yeah, in the neighborhood where Lucky used to be, at a shelter right around the corner from there. And Lucky and her son Josiah were there and for the first time saw about half of the film. And I was so relieved that she loved it. She started crying at one moment when she first saw her sister, who she hadn't spoken to in a while at that point. Mm. So it was great. And then she saw the full film in Toronto for the first time. And I'm so glad that she's into it.
So you really embraced it, obviously, because you're here for the
NYC. Actually, someone had asked me, how does it make me feel, you know, seeing the film? And I actually answered with, I really can't say how it make me feel, because every time I see it is a different emotion. I'll be sad, I'll be crying, I'll be embarrassed, I'll be laughing. So I just gave him the answer as I have different personality disorder, so I wouldn't know what my mood or what my personality is going to be when I see it again.
But this actions speak louder than words, and so if you didn't approve and respect how the movie came out, you wouldn't have shown up after the first time you saw it. You wouldn't be showing up at the Q&A, so, right, overall.
No, actually, whether I liked it or not, it was a message that I'm trying to get out there.
Okay.
At the end of the day, I'm a human being, and people judge me. People didn't understand me. People didn't know me. People thought they knew me, you know, like, the secrets of inside the shelter system, the struggles, yep. and, you know, just everything, a little bit of everything. I want people to see that just because you look like me and I have a smile on my face, you mm-hmm. know, I don't really know. I just know I want to send a message out there, you know, to those that need help, need love, need someone to say, damn, she went through that. I guess if she could tell the world, now I could sit down and actually talk to somebody about it and get it off my chest. You know, like, some people are scared to go out there and tell their business, and that's how I was for many years. Nobody knew anything about me.
Right.
All they knew is I was this angry bitch that was always fighting, didn't care about nobody's feelings, screaming at everybody. What you thought didn't count. How I felt mattered. My way or the highway. So it was like, people liked me for no reason, and I didn't even know why, because I was angry all the time, even for people that call themselves my best friends.
What do you think? What was the answer to that?
I think people enjoy being around me because I'm something that they're not, or they're afraid to be. So it's like being around me makes them more comfortable, you know, and like, mm-hmm. well, she's out there, so why should I hide myself?
I understand that. But then how do you get past that so you can make truly connect then, and that they're not just using, not to say that they're using you, but there's an aspect to that, as you described.
They are using me.
Yeah, okay. Maybe you're a little bit more blunt. But but don't you want to get past that, of course, because it's nice to have, I mean, I assume that's the case with Rico. You have a relationship, and I assume it's deeper, so... Right. And
the other women that was in my life that I was in relationship with, should I say, were complete opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of them women were compatible with me. So I think I was in and out of relationships and always angry and stuff like that, because they were judgmental themselves. They were judging me, and they was sure. in a relationship with me.
Laura, wait, one more question, Lucky, and that is only, did you have an interest in film before the documentary was being made about you?
No, I've always been doing modeling. Never thought of film, but and then I did actually tell
just
Laura.
Just about even seeing films, or you know, like, did you? Was that something that you was part of your world at all, or part of your life? Did you care about it?
Oh,
I mean, not even if you like them or any particular ones. I'm just wondering if like this was something you know. There's some people that just like that's part of their thing. They love going to movies, and it's like,
Yeah, I always used to go to the movies. Me and my son all the time.
Okay.
He liked the horror, and I liked the horror and the romance. Uh-huh. But my number one favorite movie is Twilight. So, because Edward and Bella, you know, Edward was all about Bella, and Bella was all about mm-hmm. Edward. You know, I know it's a fantasy, but it's even though they are two together, right? Like it's love. I feel like if you have the greatest love in the world, you'll be the happiest person. You won't need nothing in life, just love. I don't know. I guess because I've never had love at all in my life. It's just like, that's all I want.
Sure.
I know how to hustle. Yeah. You know?
Yep.
I know what that feel like. I know what having sex feel like. I know a lot of different terms. I know I experience a little bit of everything. Yep. I know what that, yeah. I could say I know what that feel like. But what I was searching for so many years all my life was just love. And nobody knew how to give that to me.
And Laura, did you, this is the first time you made a feature film? Had you made
yes.
shorts or
no.
had you really did you work with anybody or seek counsel or I guess I'm asking because you could have I don't know how much time you would have like in terms of avoiding mistakes or trying to you know just figuring you're navigating through that whole process of making a feature film is huge.
Yeah, and I had no idea what I was getting into, and I'm so happy I did. I am happy I didn't know because I don't
oh,
know
really?
If I would have gotten into it had I known, and now I'm hooked and I feel like can't wait to make another one and
like
faster faster. But the first couple years of the film I followed Lucky and three other women very intensively, so four it was initially about four young women.
Okay.
Lucky was one of them, and their lives sort of intersected. They were all in the same scene when I met them, but shortly after I started filming, none of them really spoke to each other anymore, and so I was just following four parallel lives. And I have about, God, like 2.5 or 3 years of footage like that. And then I dove in. Like, I came from commercial sort of entertainment journalism where mm-hmm. I never pitched stories. I always got assignments and was speaking to whomever the audience of the magazine was. So this was the first story I went after on my own and was just let so completely into these girls' lives that, I don't know, mm-hmm. I just went hard. And then when I really started editing, I never knew how to talk about that film because it was sort of just a survey more so. And I was in a fellowship and there finally people were seeing some of the raw footage for the first time and advised me to make it a complicated character portrait about Lucky and said, you can't have a character like Lucky in a film and try to make it about anyone else. And the other girls are wonderful. The other girls
like,
are
point C. Don't I'm not the only one who feels that way.
The other girls are very compelling, and I will make short films about them. But I had never even thought about making a film before. I love film just as a fan and a mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. moviegoer. But I felt like I wanted Lucky to speak for herself, and this felt like, and me writing about her, I couldn't capture her.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Definitely, she does lend herself. I shouldn't say she, third person. It's rude. Lucky lends herself to a documentary, a two dimensional. But well, Lucky, maybe we can make a 3D film out of it. Cause that would be even more appropriate, I think. Maybe.
But I did have yeah. many amazing mentors
yeah,
along the way.
That's where I was going with this.
And it's sort of magical when I think about it. And so it's been great. And in so many ways, I felt like because of the way that I made this film, that it's really a one-woman show. And I learned as I went and I did it on my own. But I've been just trying to be as thankful as possible for all the people that did help me, because there were so many. And
well, I'm thinking of one in particular. Who's your executive producer?
Yes. Well, first I want to shout out Nada Martinez, who was a producer since the beginning.
Right.
And
the thankless work, yes. By the way, the actual producer.
The one that got all the crazy emails every night in the middle of the night. And she really believed in this story from the beginning and was the one that initially told me that I was the director of the film. And I said, I am. And
it takes a while to own that.
You know, helped me get the talent release forms from day one, and just things that I would have never even known of. Yep. And yes, our executive producer, Steve James.
Holy cow.
Is awesome. And
how'd that happen? That's crazy.
So I was invited by a woman named Karina to a discussion of some really esteemed documentarians, and Steve was one of them, and I didn't even know what I was doing in that room once I was there, but she encouraged me to go up and chat with him, and I did, and I told him a bit about my film, and mm-hmm. he told me about his film Stevie, mm-hmm. which was, you know, making this film was really uphill climb, because I guess it's not following formula of a lot of sort of social issue documentaries, and has been, you know, nobody. Lucky's a difficult character. It's a really tough story. Mm-hmm. And Steve really saw the value in that and immediately said there need to be more stories about complicated, difficult people. And I got his contact information, and I didn't contact him I knew that when I had a rough cut, I would love his advice. And so I think I waited like many months until I finally had a cut that was in shape to show him. And he watched it and he gave me incredible feedback, and the story really spoke to him. And one thing led to another, and he asked to be the executive producer.
He asked, and
was a really just amazing creative advisor. And the way that he could intuit, without seeing the raw footage, just from the rough cut that I had, he could intuit what was needed story-wise and emotionally. And it was pretty incredible, because I had many wonderful editors help me through the years. And I would realize that each, like, another season would pass, and I'd be like, oh, God, I'm still sitting here editing this movie. And
I think Hope Dreams took a few years, too.
Yeah.
So don't worry about it.
So he could relate in every way.
Yeah.
And he'd worn all the hats that I was wearing. And so he didn't. He came on in the very beginning of 2013, mm-hmm. which is pretty recently, but which is right when I needed just that last touch of advice.
I have a feeling you'll have some Chicago screenings.
I hope so.
At the very least.
I hope so.
Given that relationship, that's an amazing bit of luck, or maybe, well, that's a good term for it, actually. Steve James, have you seen any films of Steve's since you should check out some of his work? He's a very talented guy.
Yeah, she hasn't, but she did get to have dinner with him in Toronto. And
nice man, right?
Yes, I have a picture with him.
Now you got to see a couple of his films. Lucky, directed by Laura Checkway, who's here, will be screening at Doc NYC Festival on Sunday, November 17th at 9:15 at the IFC Center. And then again, Play Hooky on Thursday, November 21st, because it's going to be at the IFC Center again, but at 4:30 in the afternoon. So tickets are available, and you should go check it out. And Laura, you'll be there at both of those screenings, I take it, right?
Yes.
I'll be?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to be at the Sunday. I hope that you can figure out how to cope with my not being there Thursday. I won't be at the Thursday
screen. Well, I'll miss you.
Thank you very much for opening up. Really nice meeting you. And I'm looking forward to our Q&A on a Sunday. You know?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks again for listening to the show. Please don't forget to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. And, of course, to subscribe to this podcast, if you haven't already, on iTunes. We appreciate all of your support. And, of course, look forward to hearing from you. If you want to just send me a note at adam@filmwax.com, I promise to get back to you. And please do stay tuned in future for future episodes. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Until next time.